So I'm really delighted to be here presenting. This is part of my dissertation, and so I look forward to sharing this with you and hopefully getting some interesting questions. I have no relationships to disclose. So I just wanted to give a brief overview of the next 12 minutes and what I'm trying to accomplish. So I wanted to provide a little bit of an overview of intersectionality, which is a theoretical framework that really informed all of this work, and then sort of demonstrate how intersectionality is in a really important framework for discrimination and bullying research, and how latent class analysis is a particular innovative method that aligns with intersectionality. So most of the sessions I attended yesterday, particularly the health equity one in the afternoon, intersectionality was sort of an undercurrent theme that people kept referencing. And I feel like I'm hearing it more and more in public health, which is phenomenal. It's really born out of the feminist literature, particularly the Black feminist literature. And sort of the core feature of intersectionality is that race, class, and gender are sort of social status categories that intersect and are mutually constructed, and we can't view them in isolation. We really need to look at the structural patterns that join them. And Patricia Hill Collins and Margaret Anderson have written some fabulous material on this, and they use the word matrix of domination. And really, intersectionality has been used among populations that are multiply oppressed. So Black lesbians or poor white women, so you're not just one identity. No one's ever really one identity, and we should avoid using a singular approach to define people and to define risk. However, the connection between this theory and quantitative methods is where there's a bit of a gap, and I'm hoping to share how latent class analysis can close that gap. And it's a historically grounded theory, and it's really meant to be multidisciplinary, so really calling for collaborations across disciplines. And there was a fabulous article in the July AJPH by Lisa Boleg, really stressing how intersectionality is a framework for health disparities research. And she really laid out the tenets of the theory and also talked about the struggles with the quantitative side. But there are specific implications for methods from this theory. It really calls for a social justice framework in our research questions. And there is a bit of primacy given to qualitative work just because identities are complex and nuanced, and sometimes narratives can illustrate that to a level that people can digest a little bit easier than latent class analysis. And one of the specific implications that really drew me to this was the focus on intra-group variability as opposed to the difference models that are sometimes presented in a simple odds ratio. So instead of comparing two groups that might be seemingly different, we should really focus on the disparities or differences within groups and situate that in context. And I really love this word at the bottom. The balkanization of research is definitely a phenomenon that has impacted bullying and discrimination research, particularly among youth. Most of the research is siloed, so the racial discrimination is in one camp, the sexual orientation discrimination is another, and then the weight-based discrimination is another, and often they're not talked about together. And I really wanted to show how youth actually experience these types of bullying and discrimination in tandem. They co-occur, and they co-incur in specific social patterns. So that's why intersectionality was really something that drew me. I just briefly wanted to mention that there is mounting evidence that, especially within discrimination, that have used intersectionality to show how multiple identities and multiply oppressed groups experience discrimination. And I wanted just to highlight your right column, the qualitative work, just because I feel like these quotes are really poignant and sort of stress the need for more intersectionality research. So the bottom one on the right corner was published last year by Daly and others, and it was among high school students. So this particular student was a gay African-American male, and he was trying to make meaning of different discriminatory experiences. And he says, "You get bashed because you're queer. No, no, it happened because I'm Black, and it's never that clear." So the meaning-making process that youth go through to understand potentially why a discriminatory experience happened or why they were pushed or why they were bullied is really, really important, and that's why qualitative research sometimes underscores that process a little bit more nuanced. So intersectionality also really calls researchers to think about populations and specific reasons for choosing populations for research. And I'm particularly interested in the experience of Black or African American females with weight-based discrimination, particularly because this group has a disproportionate burden of overweight. So the compounded discrimination that this group might feel really warrants further study. And there was a seminal article published over 15 years now by Diane Merkstainer and her group in Minnesota. And it was a qualitative study among overweight African American female adolescents. And they described weight-based discrimination as more personal and more harmful than racial discrimination because they weren't prepared to be made fun of because they were prepared to be made fun of because of their race, but not because of their weight. And there's a ton of work on racial socialization and racial identity being a protective factor. But this study in 1998 really opened my eyes and sort of structured my whole dissertation to understand, wow, we're not talking about these phenomenons as they're co-occurring. We're talking about them separately when actually kids experience them together. So though intersectionality really talks about race, class, and gender specifically, I argue that weight should be one of those social categories specifically for adolescents that also define their lives. And a researcher who uses ad health data published this a couple years ago, and I really love this quote because I think it sort of underscores the need to think about weight. He says, like race, therefore, body size is a physical characteristic that has been used to construct a social status hierarchy in the United States that shapes an individual's social opportunities and personal development. So I'm hoping we can add more social categories to intersectionality, particularly for adolescents, and sexual orientation should be on there as well. So discrimination is a complex construct to study. I don't know if anyone in the audience also does discrimination work. It's very complicated, and we really know very little about the co-occurrence of multiple forms of discrimination, and that's because most of our national surveys that ask about discrimination and bullying don't ask youth to attribute it why that happened. They just ask, were you ever bullied in school? And then they'll look to see, the YRBS does this, right? Have you ever been bullied in school? And then they'll see if they also identified as being a sexual minority or being of a racial ethnic minority, and then they'll say the bullying was homophobic bullying. We don't actually know that. We don't know if the kid would have identified that bullying as homophobic. We know that they identify as being a sexual minority and they experience bullying, but we can't actually make that assumption. So that's a huge, huge limitation of the research. And so I sort of view discrimination in multiple dimensions, and these three circles all help understand how youth make meaning. So the phenomenon of attributional ambiguity is something that really underscores this work. So it's not often clear why something happens to you. Why was I pushed in gym class? Or why was I excluded from a lunch table during lunch? It's not often clear. The perpetrator might not say explicitly why. And additionally, there's some research to say that pervasive discrimination is more susceptible to attributional ambiguity. And so this is something we really need to wrestle with as researchers who do work in discrimination and bullying. How youth make meaning of these situations are going to be influenced by the context. There's some really interesting work out of Ad Health in this area, and also on your individual identity. Do you personally yourself have matured into your own identity yet is going to influence the saliency of that identity in terms of how you make meaning of your life. And there's some interesting work on racial identity and even sexual orientation identity. So I wanted to study the intersection of multiple forms of discrimination, and I needed a sample that was both racially and ethnically diverse and also had the youth attribute discrimination to specific attributes. So the 2006 Boston Youth Survey did both of those things, and it's a biannual survey of high school students in the Boston public school system that's coordinated by the Harvard Youth Violence Prevention Center. And it's explicitly about violence, and the funding comes from the CDC. And in 2006, there was about 1,200 high school students that filled out the survey, and I had to drop several of them that didn't fill out the discrimination question. So my analytic sample for this current study was 965. The mean age is about 16. Most of them were sophomores, about 58% female, and also reflective of the Boston public school system. It's an extremely racially and ethnic diverse sample with over 75% of the students identifying as non-white. So I wanted to show you the actual question because this is what informed the intersectionality and latent class analysis. So students were prompted by this prompt. Sometimes people feel they are discriminated against or treated badly by other people. In the past 12 months, have you felt discriminated against because of A, your race, ethnicity, or color, B, because you or your family is from another country, C, because someone thought that you were gay, lesbian, or bisexual, or D, because of your weight. And they could check as many that apply. So this is what are the attributions of discrimination. So this is what allows me to look at the co-occurrence, because they could check more than apply. And furthermore, there was a follow-up question. In the past 12 months, have you been bullied or assaulted because of those reasons? So that's why I use the words discrimination and bullying very, very carefully, because they're actually in the survey. But the discrimination and bullying world don't talk to each other, which is a huge disservice to adolescent health research. So I wanted to say a couple words about why I chose latent class analysis to do this research. And my research questions that are on the right are, and I've mentioned them, how discrimination co-occurs, how the co-occurrence is socially patterned, and the last question is really about, do the specific combinations of attributes of discrimination have different associations with depression, suicidal ideation, and self-harm? So latent class analysis is a person-centered method, and person-centered meaning that it groups people as opposed to grouping variables. And it's a little bit more holistic for child development. And more importantly, it doesn't consider risk as additive. So it's not like a cumulative risk index score where I'm just counting the number of discrimination attributes. It really looks at the patterning of them. So it's not giving primacy or calling one oppression worse than the other. So just a quick introduction. I'm by no means an expert on latent class analysis, but I really wanted to use the dissertation to understand this method. So it's analogous to factor analysis and cluster analysis, which are methods that are used a bit more. And it's typically used with categorical variables. And as I mentioned, there's this dichotomy in the latent variable world between person-centered and variable-centered methods, which basically means, does it group people or does it group variables? So factor analysis looks at the relationship among variables, but latent class analysis looks at the relationship among people. So the basic premise of this method is that there are relationships among indicators that are driven by some underlying latent variable. So if we look back at the survey, that the relationships among all of these attributes are driven by my latent variable, which is perceived discrimination. So that perceived discrimination can explain how all of these co-occur. And that there are subpopulations of individuals that share similar response profiles. So literally the hardware that goes into a latent class analysis is just the response profiles of these questions. And it's really a data reduction technique. So instead of just looking at a large contingency table or seeing a large response pattern, it helps you identify patterns that you wouldn't be able to see because it's impossible to look at that many zeros and ones. So there are two really primary parameters that are produced from an LCA. I'm just going to quickly go over this because it's sort of helpful for the next graph. Everyone has a probability of membership in a specific latent class. And once you're in that class, there's something that are called item class probabilities, which are the probability of endorsement of an item given class membership. And I'll show that to you in a second. So I'm not going to spend too much time on the steps of this. There's a fabulous chapter published by Catherine Mason, and she's the statistician that I'm working with at the Harvard Graduate School of Education, because there are a couple different camps. Penn State has a fabulous latent class analysis methods as well, but I'm sort of following the M plus mu 10 Mason camp, if you will. So the first step in latent class analysis is to identify the number of classes. And you do that by starting with one class, and then you increase it by one. So compare the second class to a class that has one class, compare a class that has three classes to a class that has two classes. And there are lots of different relative and absolute fit indices. And I'm not going to go into that because that will bore everyone. And really, to determine the number of classes, you really should base it on theory, previous research in this area, model fit indices, and substantive interest. You shouldn't just rely on the fit indices. And then once you have your measurement model, which is the number of classes, you can relate class membership to outcomes and predictors. And that's really helpful to assist with the substantive meaning of each class and also to understand, to validate, really, latent class membership. So here are the results, and I want to orient everyone to this graph. So the x-axis are the indicators that I showed everyone. These are the five indicators of latent class. So did you experience racial discrimination, immigration discrimination, sexual orientation discrimination, weight, and then bullying? And on the y-axis are the item class probabilities. So given class membership, what's the probability that you endorsed experiencing that item? And this helps determine the classes. So the brown class at the bottom, which is about 50% of the sample, experienced sort of no discrimination. The blue class, which is characterized by experiencing sort of racial discrimination alone. And then the green and the red classes are really the intersectionality classes. These are the classes that have experienced more than one type of discrimination. And in the latent class analysis world, you hear the terms homogeneity and separation a lot. So the item that separates the green and the red class the most is bullying. And what you notice is the first time that bullying has a probability of endorsement above 50% is the class where weight is also in the latent class membership. So the red class is racial, weight-based discrimination, and bullying. So the first time that bullying or being physically assaulted for that attribute is in conjunction with weight, which is a finding consistent with the literature. So then I wanted to look at who is in each of these classes to see if that helps determine what's going on. And I found that there were some significant predictors of latent class membership. So these are all based on conditional probabilities, which are really awkward interpretations. So I'm just going to go over one for the sake of going over one. So if we look at the green class, which is the sexual orientation discrimination class, compared to the no discrimination class, students who identified as being a sexual minority had 12 times the odds of being in the sexual orientation discrimination class compared to their sexual majority peers. So that's why the conditional probability, because it's two conditions actually. But this helps us understand that both perceiving discrimination and your actual reality of identifying in a sexual minority are consistent here. So this is an important finding. Finally, I wanted to see if the combinations matter for emotional health. Do the specific patterning of discrimination have different associations with depression, self-injury, and suicidal ideation? And these models are all controlled for age, BMI, sexual orientation, and race. So you can see if we take model 2, which is intentional self-injury, compared to the no discrimination class, the sexual orientation group and the race, weight, and bullying had 7 times the odds of indicating that they engaged in intentional self-injury in the past 12 months. But you'll notice that the racial discrimination group, that was not a significant outcome for them. And same thing with suicidal ideation, there were different relationships in the discrimination classes. So there are a couple of theories that can help explain these findings. And I just wanted to mention sort of the in-group identity theory, just because I don't think I have time to go over all of them. But the sexual orientation and the race, weight, bullying class, the students that are in those classes might have a lack of in-group identity that the students in the racial discrimination class might have. So there's a lot of work around racial identity and racial socialization being a protective or a buffer against the implications of discrimination. But because sexual orientation and weight-based discrimination lacks the social support, because we know that there is a significant amount of internalization of the anti-fat bias among overweight individuals and internalization of homophobia, that they might themselves think poorly of their perceived group membership or actual group membership. So this is something really to consider, because there's a lack of social support for these students to band around potential people that look like them or they think that look like them to do something about experience bullying. So in conclusion, adolescents are experiencing multiple forms of discrimination simultaneously, and that being physically victimized co-occurs with weight-based discrimination. And I think LCA is really an optimal innovative method that illustrates really the nuance and complexity of discrimination. And there's a couple implications that I want to stress. So we know from the GLESN, which is the Gay, Lesbian, Straight Education Network, that LGBT students who are in schools that have policies, anti-bullying policies, that enumerate LGBT status as a protected attribute feel safer in those schools. So should we be doing the same thing for weight? Should we be doing the same thing for religion? Should we be doing the same thing for immigration? That's not yet studied. And we also know that teachers feel differently following up with different types of discrimination and bullying. And there was a fabulous study done by the National Teacher Education Association or something like that, I can forward it on to people, that showed that teachers didn't feel as well equipped to deal with homophobic bullying. So programmatic implications, this is the area that's really understudied. We don't know if interventions that decrease racial discrimination can also have the same effect in decreasing weight-based discrimination. And in research, this is where the call to action to everyone in this room. There is a ton of work to be done in research, improving our measures of bullying and discrimination, inquiring about attributes and contexts, and also increasing collaborations among researchers who do different types of bullying. And then education and training. I didn't learn about intersectionality in my doctoral work. I found it because I was lacking some of this. So I feel like this should be a fundamental theory that we learn in our education and training. And I really think it should inform the way that we communicate health disparities, because health disparities are fundamentally comparing two groups. I want to acknowledge my dissertation committee and the Harvard Youth Violence Prevention Center that runs the Boston Youth Survey. And I have a ton of references if anyone is interested. I love literature and I love reading, so if you all have references that I should be aware of, I'd love to hear about it. And thank you for your time. Thank you.